Welcome. This is Real Estate Investing, live from New York with James Nelson, the principal and head of Avis & Young's Tri-State Investment Sales Group. In this program, you'll learn about the world of commercial real estate and find out why it's one of the largest investment opportunities in New York and around the world. Now, here is your host, James Nelson.
Welcome to episode number 92 of Real Estate Investing Live from New York. This is your host, James Nelson. I am principal and head of Tri-State Investment Sales for Avis & Young. Thank you, as always, for joining. It means so much to me. And for those of you who have already checked out my newest site, jamesnelson.com, this is a resource hub for you. I built this site to help you have all the information and tools that you need to be the most successful investor possible. You can find all of our podcasts there, but you can also find an exclusive video series. If you sign up on the website, you're going to get a step-by-step guide on how to invest and gain the insider's edge to real estate investing. So for today's show, you are certainly going to learn those traits as well and those skills from Atit Jariwala. I've entitled this episode The Enthusiast because that is what Atit embodies, the passion, the desire that has fueled him throughout his career. And for him, he talks about all the hard work, but he talks about how he loves the business, and that certainly is what keeps him going. He also has an incredibly interesting perspective, as he is also a startup venture investor. So he also has a lot of visibility into the technology space that has helped being fueled the real estate business. Lastly, I'll say you definitely want to listen to this episode throughout. He gives a recap of the time that he negotiated a lease one-on-one with Tesla's Elon Musk. You're going to want to hear this. So we're going to have a brief word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with that episode with Atit Jariwala.
Hi, I'm Mark Rose, Global CEO of Avis & Young, the world's fastest growing real estate services firm, and we are proud supporters of Voice America. With over 5,000 professionals in 120 offices in 20 countries, Avis & Young delivers local expertise in partnership with global reach. Because we are principally owned, Avis & Young prioritizes client success over shareholder profits. Through our open architecture, our firm's experts provide value-added, client-centric investment sales, leasing, advisory, management, and financing services to clients across the office, retail, industrial, multifamily, and hospitality sectors. Our culture is the bedrock for collaboration that enables each assignment to benefit from the collective intelligence garnered from a company-wide database. Partnership, performance. Learn how we deliver different at avisandyoung.com to learn more.
You are listening to Real Estate Investing, live from New York. To find out more about James Nelson or Avis & Young, visit avisandyoung.com. Now, back to our show.
And now it's time for our Investor Spotlight. And with us today is my friend Atit Jariwala, who is CEO of Bridgeton Holdings, which is a hospitality and real estate firm. Atit is an enthusiast who operates, owns, and invests in a multitude of business types and asset classes, as well as in technology ventures that intersect with the physical world. With a national portfolio currently valued near $1 billion, Atit has owned and operated over 50 hotels, dozens of office buildings, industrial parks, and residential buildings. With an unwavering entrepreneurial spirit, Atit has found numerous startups and is an active venture capitalist, investing in many technology startups. He's also an honored board member of one of New York's largest nonprofits, the Henry Street Settlement, and he received his MBA from Stanford and his BA from Yale. So we're going to get into all of this, and welcome and thank you for joining us today, Atit.
Thank you, James. Glad to be on and seeing you again. It's been a little bit.
Absolutely. I can't wait till it's in person again. I know it will be soon. So Atit, tell us, where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in Bridgeton, Missouri, actually in St. Louis, Missouri, and there's a town called Bridgeton where my parents had an Econolodge motel that they managed, and we grew up there in two rooms. I kind of lived there for the first years of our lives, and that's where I kind of grew up. My chores in the motel were cleaning rooms, doing the laundry, running the front desk. So I haven't been able to shake real estate since those early days.
Well, I'm like envisioning Schitt's Creek here. I don't know if you, right. Was that, I mean, am I anywhere close? Was that, next to each other?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. It wasn't that bad. Although I will say that there was quite a few guests that came in with just cash wads, and I didn't understand why so many people had cash and, all the time. And there were some maintenance issues, but the motel was a little bit better well run. Although Econo Lodges aren't that great.
Well, I mean, I'm sure growing up around that, I mean, and you said you were pitching in at a early age. So were you, I mean, you were really learning the business from the ground up.
Yeah. I mean, from the time I could walk, you know, it was like, those are the chores we would do. You know, it started off with picking rocks off the pavement, or, you know, picking weeds out of the grass. And then it obviously went up to laundry and housekeeping and kind of every role you can imagine in a motel.
So you end up getting your BA from Yale. So I've got to assume going from the St. Louis area, kind of, I guess there's kind of a rural area, to, you know, going to one of the best colleges in the country, if not the world. I mean, I've got to imagine you were probably a stellar student. I mean, what was your path to get there?
Yeah. To get to Yale, I'll valedictorian in my class. I played tennis. I played ice hockey for a year in high school. I did track for a year too. I played the trombone as an instrument, and I was involved with a lot of the class clubs. I was president of probably half the clubs. So I was just very actively involved while also working in school. I had never visited Yale. You know, my high school really never sent anyone to Ivy League schools. Ivy League didn't come and recruit. The only reason I applied is I was going grocery shopping for my mother one day, and there was this U.S. News and World Magazine report in the aisle before checkout. And I'm like, it's the college report. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I was like a junior. I was like, why don't I pick this up and look at it? And I flipped it open. I looked at the rankings. And that year, Yale and Harvard were tied for number one, but Yale's acceptance rate was higher. So I was like, okay, well, I'm like, I got this SAT score and I got this GPA. Like, why don't I give it a shot? And so I was going to only apply to one because, you know, I didn't think I had a chance anyway. So I called Yale up. They mailed me back in the day. They mailed me the Howard application. They had the electronic application, but it wasn't widely used. And I typed in my application and sent it in and got in. I never visited the campus. It was great. It was kind of crazy.
Wow. So you just show up to school. You had never been to the campus before.
No. I mean,
what kind of adjustment was that like then when you showed up?
You know, it was a pretty big adjustment. I went to a high school that, you know, it was a great high school. I mean, in terms of friendliness, everyone was nice. It was safe, but it wasn't a high achieving high school. It was just, it just was a normal school where athletics were more, you know, pronounced than academics. And so going to a school like Yale, where a lot of the folks have learned a lot, you know, like half the school probably goes to private schools, and they learn so much. I remember one of my roommates, like, they were taking something I thought was crazy. They took Shakespearean literature in their junior year or something in high school. I'm like, I took English 3, you know, and so it was a bit of a, in the diversity was great, you know. I think I was one of like three minority students in a 300 person class. And so, you know, going from that atmosphere to a place where it was very diverse, lots of different cultures, different academic backgrounds, but it was fun.
So did you know that you wanted to pursue business? I mean, was that a passion? I mean, did you ever think you'd go back and work in the family business and maybe, you know, expand the hotel portfolio? Was that in your mind?
No, it wasn't. At the time, I kind of wanted to just do my own thing. I wanted to be able to figure it out. And I was getting a liberal arts degree. And, you know, I didn't know what that meant. You know, frankly, I came into it without knowing what I wanted to do in the future. And so I really just had my friends. I remember one day, one of my friends, his name is Rudy, he was like, hey, Goldman Sachs is having a information session on investment banking. You're coming, right? I'm like, what is investment banking? Who is Goldman Sachs? You know, what are you talking about? Like, we never heard about that stuff in Missouri. You know, like that just was not where, you know, not common. And so, you know, I'm like, fine, I'll go. He's like, basically he said, this is the job everyone does. This in consulting, you know, from Yale, if you're a business degree and you're not going into academics or medicine or something, or going on to further education. And so I went to the, information sessions, and, I ended up working in investment banking out of college, at Citibank's and so I took that job at, just think I was going to be an investment banker. And at the time you have to go to different groups. You do this like little thing in the first 6 to 8 weeks where you meet different groups. And given my background in hospitality, I had worked at the motels during summers and stuff. The real estate and lodging group took a liking to me and asked that I join the group. And so I ended up being in their real estate lodging group at Citibank's investment bank. And so that's kind of got me into finance here in New York.
Was real estate in the picture at all? I mean, obviously Citi, you know, one of the biggest lenders out there. I mean, was that, did you ever get any exposure to real estate while you were there?
No, just the capital markets, just M&A and fundraising, basically. You know, just like IPOs, secondary offerings in the public markets for these large real estate companies. So it wasn't really a real estate job per se. It was more of a capital markets job, understanding how the capital markets work and M&A activity.
Got it. And so how many years were you at Citi before, because your next move was to get your MBA from Stanford? Is that where you went next?
So I actually worked at a couple of investment banks, first with Citi for a year and a half, and then was at a company called Wells Hill Partners, which is a boutique real estate investment banking firm in New York, for 2 years. And that was more granular at the real estate level. We're really understanding real estate fundamentals with some brilliant guys there. And then I worked in real estate private equity at a boutique firm in New York for a couple of years. And then I went to Stanford for business school.
And why did you decide to go back and get your MBA?
The Great Recession. That was really the main reason, to be honest. I'd gone a little later in my career. I was 30 when I started business school. And at the time I thought, you know, I was at least at Stanford, most of the guys there were 26, 27. And I had missed kind of the window, earlier window that most people do, 45 years, but I was working in what I thought was, I was doing well in my career. So why would I take a time out to go to a business school where I was already learning business? But the Great Recession hit and I wasn't doing any real estate deals. So I was like, well, you know, I thought about, you know, business school. And so I just applied to a couple of firms, a couple of universities.
And hopefully you visited before you showed up.
I did. This time
I can't go wrong. If it's Stanford, you'd only be, I'm sure, pleasantly surprised. So what were your major takeaways there? And was there, I mean,
yeah.
These incredible networks. I mean, I'm sure, I mean, you look at all the entrepreneurs and we're going to get into some of your tech investing. So you were like right in the heart of that. So was that what kind of started to expose you to that world as well?
Yeah. I mean, just to step back for a second. I mean, going to business school and for my experience at Stanford was much more than I imagined. You know, I thought it was like something where I was going to read textbooks and learn kind of a little bit more, you know, academics around how business worked. What I got out of it was, frankly, my best friends, a lot of learnings about how business works, some great mentors, and a huge, massive network of people that can they can provide advice, and it helped me out. And it was just a great 2 years of just getting a break out of life, you know. And it was less serious, frankly. Business school is less serious than undergrad. Because they focus more on team building and management skills versus just, you know, some equation that you have to, you know, calculate in some calculus class. And so like I got a lot out of it. And going to a place like Stanford, which was really helpful to me, is that I was probably the only real estate guy in my class, which was great because many of my classmates that went into venture capital or startups, a lot of them have real estate questions. And I naturally was the person they would ask, which, to get your question, James, was how I got into venture, because I would advise almost, you know, many of the top venture firms in the country, because they're based in Silicon Valley, on their prop tech investments, and casually, or connect them with other real estate players, and naturally I would get allocations of their rounds.
That's awesome. I mean, that's just such incredible experience, and I'm sure that has certainly been a big foundation and key to your success. So what did you end up doing after you graduated?
So I started Bridgeton Holdings while I was in business school. And Bridgeton is a vertically integrated owner, operator, developer of commercial real estate. We own and operate hotels, office buildings, multifamily, and some industrial assets across the country. We have about $1 billion portfolio. You know, we had up to 25 hotels about a couple years ago. We sold in 2019 a number of those hotels, but we still have, you know.
Wow, the timing on this before COVID. I mean, sometimes I guess luck can really play a big part, right?
It was 100% luck. I did not time that at all. And you know, part of that was just the desire to stay focused, and we thought it was a pretty hot market, and so we were we had exited some deals back then, but you know, but half the portfolio is hospitality, half is probably office, and a little bit of a multifamily and industrial assets. Primary focus in New York and San Francisco.
So maybe you could tell us about one of your first deals. I mean, what was the size? How did you raise the money for it? I mean, acquisition, you know, I'm sure that had to be a little bit nerve-wracking, right?
It was really nerve-wracking, actually. It was a friend of mine that I'd actually met from business school, and actually approached me and said, hey, it's a wealthy family. And they said, hey, we have a large international real estate exposure. And, you know, we would love to have U.S. real estate exposure. And so they said, hey, we want to build a diversified portfolio. So our first deal was a multifamily deal in Kips Bay, New York, these five buildings on 33rd Street. And we bought them from an owner operator. They used some third party management. We managed it, and then we ended up selling it 3 years later, and they funded the entire thing.
Wow. So I got to ask, I mean, if you'd never owned and operated multifamily in New York, and for some of our listeners who are active outside the city, I've got to say, New York, from what I've heard, is the most complicated landscape when it comes to multifamily, all the rent regulation guidelines. I mean, how did this family trust you to go in and execute on this business strategy when you had great experience in schooling, but, you know, as far as actual hands-on operating experience, I mean, this was totally new. So how did you convince them to do that?
We had good lawyers. No, but, you know, we got up to speed. I've been involved in looking at a lot of these deals for quite a bit of time. We kissed a lot of frogs, looked at a lot of deals before we closed on that deal, evaluated a lot of things, got comfortable with rent regulation. Now, James, this is many years ago, so it was less regulated than it was now. But it was kind of a clear path to, like, that portfolio was 40% regulated, 60% free market. So it wasn't a fully regulated property either.
Right. And back in the day, that was considered a good thing. That was your upside, where if you had rents that were regulated and below market, artificially low, that if you could try to, you know, wait for vacancy, that you had this incredible upside. So tell our listeners a little bit, because I know you deal with a lot of foreign capital. Yes, they want diversification. They want the safety. But what are their considerations when they're thinking about investing here? I mean, you hear sometimes these groups come in, they only want to buy 49% because they don't want to be the owner. There's all this, you know, tax treatment, although typically they bring the money here and then I guess they're taxed as if it's here. Maybe, I mean, we could spend an hour talking about this, but maybe a little bit, you know, the bullet points of what foreign investors are thinking when they come here and you know, ways that they like to come in to be most tax efficient.
Yeah. So, I mean, James, like you said, we could probably spend a day talking about foreign tax structuring, and depending on what state, if there's a tax treaty with that country, I'm sorry, which country, tax treaty with that country, like, you know, and because that makes a massive difference. You know, a country with a tax treaty with the U.S. is a lot easier to deal with from a tax perspective than some countries where there isn't a tax treaty, which has been my case. And in that case, it's a pretty complex structuring of how to get money offshore in a regular basis. Previously, we were able to do that as shareholder debt. If things are characterized as shareholder debt, you can send it over as dividend payments. Not dividend payments, as interest payments on the debt. And the U.S. tax rules are changing a bit, so we're a bit figuring that out today. But a lot of times, you may have to, you know, hold the cash on shore, and then when the property is exited and complete, you can send it back. And so you are right. A lot of times we have to keep it on shore until the sale of the asset. A lot of times, a lot of foreign capital are literally looking for is diversity from their own. I mean, the U.S. is the most liquid market in the world. It's also the most stable. You can buy title insurance here. You actually understand the risks. You can't get that in most countries. And so people come here for stability. And what we've found with a lot of countries is they want assets that generate dividend income, something that where they can get payments on a regular basis, or they think they can get payments on a regular basis. There are some other investors that like development deals. They like the upside. But it really depends on the family office and like who you're dealing with, because it's so broad.
Makes a ton of sense. And I think what you said right off the bat of having good counsel, that is, they earn their fees with all this structuring and making sure that you don't fall in any pitfalls. So you end up building this portfolio, and I know now you've got extensive holdings here in New York and out on the West Coast. So from there, did you just start building a portfolio? You started acquiring some hotels. Was this all in New York City? And if so, was that because that's really what the foreign investors wanted?
Yeah, so that was a big thing. So depends. Some foreign investors just look at the United States and like, hey, it's the United States. I want a 10% coupon. I'll buy in Omaha, and that's fine because it's multifamily in Omaha. Great. Some of the investors we dealt with were like, Omaha, I've never heard of that place. Like, I want New York City. I want San Francisco. I want LA. I want DC. I want Boston. And so for our mandate was those major cities. And so we primarily focused in New York and the New York region, Boston and San Francisco, with our original investors. Now we invest across the country. Or I should say, you know, in between that early stage and maybe a year ago, we had invested across the country. We're now back focused on New York City and San Francisco, which we found that having a concentration of our time and energy has been really helpful, as well as having relationships with like folks like you, James, that can show us deals that make a lot of sense for us, being hyper-local and being understanding the market and being folks that can see deals in real time as they come up and not having to prove that we're real.
And did you have the same capital partners? Or do you have a stable of investors? Was everything kind of deal specific? I mean, I got to imagine with the complexity to do one of these deals, it would make sense to do something programmatic.
That's right. So we've done, as Bridgeton, we've probably done 4 or 5 dozen projects now. So, you know, 40 to 50 projects. We did the first dozen or so was with the same capital partner. And then since then, we've diversified it and worked with many other capital partners, institutions, high net worth, ultra high net worth families, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And not to try to, pry with your into your playbook, but just I think I'm sure a lot of our listeners are thinking, you know, access to capital might be one of their greatest challenges to breaking in. So, you know, for our listeners who have found this incredible opportunity, there's all this foreign capital that wants safety for all the reasons that you mentioned. So let's say they've figured out how to access that foreign capital. And I believe you said on the first deal, they put up all the money. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. So, I mean, they're posting the deposit, they're taking that risk, but you obviously have to get compensated as well. So, you know, to what extent, you know, just so the listeners can understand structure? Is it, you know, like an acquisition fee? Is it an asset management fee? Is it some kind of promote? You know, how would you set something up like that when you don't have capital in the deal yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'd say, so I should have said they put the majority of the capital in on that first deal. But you're right, that first deal, they took a lot of the risk that normally you wouldn't. And in return, they got a really good deal. So I'd say I was looking at the forest through the trees, and I wasn't stuck on knowing that I could only do one or two good deals or three good deals. I was like, hey, this is something that I can work with this partner where it's going to be a win-win for both of us. They're going to get a great fee structure. They're going to get better fees in general, but they're going to put up more of the equity. They're going to take greater risks on me as a manager. And it's worked out for both of us, frankly. That capital partner is very happy. We look at deals all the time with them still. And, you know, our deal structure is a little different than it was in the first deals, because now I put up risk capital today. But like you said, at the beginning, it was that capital partner that did take the risk. And I've advised that, like, you know, don't look at the one deal. You're going to do many deals in your career. So like, yeah, maybe you're not going to retire on your first two, three, four deals. That's okay. You got a long career. Like, get a track record, because all you need is a track record to really build a business. And even a short one.
It's such incredible advice. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe for some of our listeners who have yet to make their first investment, maybe they're waiting for that home run deal where, you know, you knock it out of the park. And I think, to your point, to just get in the game and get that experience and that track record, because, you know, that is something that you can leverage. You get known. I mean, I'm sure we connected very early on, because you start, you know, the press that's being generated, you get known as a buyer. And, you know, when we, from the broker's perspective, again, when we have someone bidding on a property, we want to know, hey, you know, are you capable? Have you done this before? So I think that was really wise of you to look at the big picture and not say, hey, you know, how do I keep all the economics to myself for this first one? So and to do a dozen transactions after with that same partner, I think is certainly a testament to that. So, you start off with these multi deals in New York. When did you start building up the hotel portfolio? And I know now you've developed the best hotels and some incredible neighborhoods, the Village. We're going to talk about your latest hotel that you just opened, you know, amidst the pandemic, the Walker Hotel. But, you know, did you start off kind of converting some of these older hotels and being in a flag? Maybe explain how that works for our audience.
Yeah, so started off with a couple of hotels in the Midwest that were smaller, got like an understanding of the business, started building out a small team on how to operate these hotels or branded properties, and then bought a little bit more in the Northeast a little bit. But really, it wasn't until I started building the Walkers where I was really putting out more capital and kind of really taking larger swings. And it was really all about the team, building out a team to manage and operate these things. Hotels are operationally intensive. So you got revenue management, sales and marketing, engineering, accounting. And so I decided to build my own team. You know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to everybody. You know, it might be easier to outsource it to a professional hotel operator if you're just focused on buying. Because I was born in a motel, essentially. Like, I was used to it, and it was natural for me to operate. But if you're not, it's a business that you kind of really want to understand. It's like running a coffee shop. You know, you gotta really want to know how daily inventory works and lots of staff and whatnot. But
yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned the operating piece to it, because you know, and I've handled the occasional hotel sale, but you know, I is an entirely separate asset class. It's an operating business, you know? And so, and many of you, I mean, you see these Marriotts all over the world, and you know, some of you might be surprised to know that Marriott probably, you know, owns probably a couple percent of the actual hotels that they actually manage. So they're basically just there getting management agreements, whether it's the 20, 25 years, and they're going to help you collect, obviously run the hotel and get bookings. But, you know, maybe it is worthwhile spending a little more time about, because you've also opened some very successful boutique hotels. So, you know, the choice of letting someone else manage it and putting a flag and tapping into their booking system. And I'm sure, you know, there's a cost for that, right? As opposed to opening your own flag and trying to fill it. So how do you, what approach did you take for operating?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, what I found with the branded hotels is that you're taking someone else's playbook and repeating it. And they tell you exactly what to do. And for me, that wasn't exciting. It wasn't exciting on a day-to-day perspective. And I also found that the world was going more towards unique, interesting experiences, which is you can find on Instagram. You know, prior to Instagram, prior than that, you know, the iPhone, you know, was created in 2007. It wasn't that long ago. You know, people didn't have access. They wanted surety of stay, that there was a good breakfast, there was a good bed, there was a good shower. And so they flocked to Marriott's and Hilton's and IHG and all the brands because they created their brand as a consistent experience. What the brands didn't do until recently is realize that, you know, now that people can easily check reviews on their phone and see pictures and get recommendations, like they're not seeking a kind of plain vanilla experience time and time again. You don't only want to stay at a Holiday Inn Express so many times, you know, like it sells its utility. And so for me, that wasn't exciting. For me, what was exciting is being able to craft a property that attracted guests that I could be proud of and that it's enjoyable to work at. You know, I'm like, I want to work on projects that are fun and exciting and unique. And also it's what guests want, luckily. So it kind of wins, it win-win. So that's why we've decided to go pretty much exclusively boutique. That's kind of what we focus on today.
So I want to jump forward till today just so we can continue the arc of the hotel. Yeah. I want to go back and talk about some of your office investing and what you've been doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've got to, and you were kind enough to walk me through your Walker Hotel very early on in the process. And, you know, congrats on its opening. I mean, such an incredible project. But, you know, I mean, you were right in the midst of this. I mean, what was that like? What were the challenges to getting this finished and, you know, getting this up and running?
Yeah, I mean, the Walkers and being in the hotel business in general, but I mean, this talk of the Walkers, it was painful because, you know, we were in the process of opening, basically it's soft open, COVID hit, and now all of a sudden our plans were all screwed up. You know, we couldn't open the restaurant, couldn't open the coffee shop, couldn't open the speakeasy, couldn't open the rooftop, couldn't open the lobby. You know, it's a relatively large hotel. We had staff, we had to make very difficult decisions with our staff, which stinks because like we were, you know, just prior to COVID, we were on like a company high in a lot of ways. A lot of our properties were doing really well. And that was ramping up. And then all of a sudden, like kind of demoralizing to make very difficult decisions. And the folks that stuck around had to work in pretty hard, you know, we're in the hospitality business. We're frontline workers in a lot of ways. You know, guests are coming in. They may or may not have COVID and we're sitting there having to check people in. And a lot of times the hotel would be empty. It'd be one front desk, you know, one manager sitting at the front desk. So it was a scary time. Now, what was great about this all, which I learned a lot, is that I didn't hear a lot of complaints. I didn't hear a lot of people saying, hey, like, you know, I'm working in these tough scenarios and like, I can't believe you're letting me go. And that are, all I heard is like, I totally understand. I'm so sorry you have to go through this. You know, we're here with you. Everyone making sacrifices, working harder, getting paid less. I mean, it was a special time in the sense of making me rethink humanity and like thinking about like how you treat people and how the world works together in a time of crisis, because it certainly was the case with our team that everyone came together in a pretty great way. I mean, and now that we're, you know, I know COVID's not over, but we're on the opposite side of this. You know, we can't hire quick enough right now at all these properties. But it was a scary, sad, crazy time that entire in the last year and a half.
Wow. I mean, I can't even imagine, but you know, to be able to get through that and to come out stronger, because I've got to imagine a lot of the competition, you know, will fall by the wayside as well. I mean, some of these hotels may never open again. So, I mean, the fact that you're able to deliver this and, you know, it really just seems being, you know, back in New York full time for me and, you know, being out and about, I mean, people, you could see how much they've missed, you know, being out and interacting. And so to have, you know, the rooftop and all the F&B space you have there, you know, you are definitely hopefully, you know, reaping the rewards of all your hard work there and your patience.
100%. You can tell people are pouncing to go out. They're looking for a fun time. They're getting out. We're busy. It's an incredible feeling. It's an incredible feeling. New York's back.
So let's change gears and talk a little bit about office. First of all, the fact that you've been involved in multifamily hotels and office, I mean, each asset class is so different, you know, different sets of challenges, you know, different landscape. I mean, breaking into office, I mean, you are dealing with some of the biggest REITs out there. I mean, not to say that the REITs aren't buying multi or hotel, but, you know, again, these are sizable capital investments. They need a lot of money to get started, get tenanted. So maybe tell us about one of your early office deals. And I remember, and I'd love if you could recount the story of having a lease negotiation with no other than Elon Musk from Tesla. So maybe you want to talk about that deal and how that all happened.
Yeah, sure. That was actually our first office deal in San Francisco. So at a high level, we focus on San Francisco office. We're good at it. You know, like I mentioned before, we kind of spread ourselves a bit thin where we were going into new markets and we were always a new player in town. And we realized that, like, it's hard to compete sometimes being just a new player in town. And so what we were trying to do is focus on the markets that we know a lot of folks, like New York City, San Francisco. And in SF office, San Francisco office, I also have the double benefit of being well-known and knowing a lot of venture capitalists. And so with a lot of the tenants in these office buildings, I can underwrite our tenants really well. And so that was kind of like my secret sauce in San Francisco, is I can underwrite a lot of the tenants in these office buildings there. I can't really do that everywhere, you know? It's usually where there's a Silicon Valley presence and where I can really know the tenant, otherwise I'm just another office owner. But my first deal in San Francisco was a building called the Pioneer Building in the Mission area of San Francisco. It was a really cool building. We bought the building from a firm that bought this and did a pretty good renovation during the Great Recession. There was five tenants in the building. One of the tenants was actually Stripe, the unicorn printer process. So this was their first headquarters was this building. In a great firm, they were one of five tenants. They didn't have a lot of space. As they were rapidly growing, they started taking all the other spaces in the building. They took the building across the street, another building a block over. I mean, they just started growing so quickly. It was crazy. It's another Silicon Valley story. And, eventually, you know, they had like 3 years left on the lease or something. And eventually they said, hey, listen, we're consolidating all our employees into one big building. And they moved and built the headquarters, and they're like, hey, we just want to get out of the lease. And so I started searching for a tenant, and I ended up getting Elon Musk's office reached out to me and said, hey, you know, Elon's interested in leasing your building. And I'm like, okay. And I was talking to some other tenants, so he had known that I was looking. He had a partner in this company called OpenAI who had reached out to me, and then eventually they said, hey, Elon wants to talk to you direct. And I'm like, are you free? I'm like, yeah, I'm free. When? He's like, I can talk to you in an hour. I'm like, all right, I'm free. Here's my phone number. And so just an amazing guy. I ended up talking on the phone a few times, emailing back and forth. We were negotiating the lease. You know, at one point I'm like, so should I connect your lawyers with my lawyers, or how should we do this? And he's like, no, he's like, you and I can handle this. I'm like, okay, yeah, fantastic. I can do that. I mean, I never go through 70-page leases solo, but I guess I'll do that this time. So eventually, we had gotten to a stage where, you know, we were getting close to finalizing. And he's like, hey, why don't you come meet me at Tesla, their X days of the week. And so I drove up to Tesla's factory in Milpitas in San Francisco, in California. And they give me a little private tour of the factory. And then he's like, I guess he apparently offices in different parts of the Tesla factory, or he did at the time, and meets with everybody. It's crazy. I mean, the guy meets with he's so into the weeds. There must have been a huge line. I don't know how many people, 20, 25 people waiting out the line of this glass office in the middle of the Tesla factory. And I meet up with one of the folks that works with him, and they're like, hey, Elon, we'll see you next as soon as this next office, next meeting is done. Here's a cup of coffee. And so I cut the line. I sit down with him for a couple hours, and we're just page flipping this lease, negotiating it one-on-one. And we got it done. He's like, lawyers are just going to screw this up. I know I want the building. He's like, at the end of the day, I want your building. I'm going to pay you rent. You just want a tenant that pays rent. That's all that matters. Why should I, pay someone to like mark this up in redline in something that doesn't matter? And I'm like, you're right. That's true. So why not? So it was a great deal.
I mean, when you first told me that story, I was just blown away. First of all, because it's Elon Musk, and that's just, the thought of you kind of, him sitting in a glass box in the middle of a factory and going in there to meet with him. But, it also makes you think, sometimes maybe we make this business too complicated. A typical lease issue could be 6 months cut through it. I'm still amazed that he was actually one that would do it. You would think with that size of an organization that, he would have people. You have a real estate department. It's just crazy to think. And this wasn't, how long ago was this?
I think 4 years ago.
Yeah. It's not like it was 10 years ago when they were still just a concept. This was, wow.
No. He basically said it. He's like, he could easily have hired a lawyer. He has tons of lawyers. I think it was for him, it was like, I want this building. I want what I want. You just want rent ultimately in a tenant that doesn't go out of business. I will make you happy. Let's just get this done. Why would we just spend hours negotiating eminent domain clauses and casualty clauses and garbage that never happens, what's the point,
He's kind of right. He's kind of right. But, something that you said earlier about your key to success with office is really knowing your tenants. And I hope it's lost on the audience because, that you are taking a calculated risk, right? Because the amount of time and effort and money to get a tenant in the space and then, if they can't pay the rent and then you have to get them out, it is a very, very costly mistake. So the fact that you were able to do your due diligence on these tenants, and I'm sure you'd tell us that, hey, sometimes the highest rent is not the best rent to take. Because especially with you need to make sure that they're going to, do the right thing. So I'm sure that was a big part also of qualifying.
100%. I actually think my office investments in San Francisco are the same as my angel investments in San Francisco. But exactly what you said, James, I'm in the tenant's business. If I don't understand their business, just because they're paying a dollar today, it doesn't mean they're going to pay a dollar tomorrow because they can easily go out of business. I need to understand exactly what they do, how capitalized are they, what's their cash flows, how long are they going to be in business, what's their capital stack, who's backing them, what's the references, what's the product. I have to understand everything about them, otherwise there's a big risk they go out. And that's kind of how we've been thinking about our office investments for sure. You have to understand the tenant.
That's amazing. And it really makes real estate so much more, three, four dimensional in the sense that, there's this extra, it's not just about the brick and mortar and really understanding the tenant's business. You don't hear a lot of operators speak about that. So, we love to hear a little bit about your angel investing. And was that just a natural byproduct? So you're already, you've got your network through Stanford. You're seeing them on the tenant side. Did that give you access and a foray into these investments? How did you start getting into angel investing?
Yeah. So I got into angel investing primarily because of my classmates from business school worked at, many of the venture firms you've heard of and in Silicon Valley. And so they would approach me with a question around, hey, I remember one of the first one was Realty Mogul, which was this crowdfunding platform. And one of my friends would call me and said, hey, we're thinking about backing this company. Is capital an issue in real estate? And I'm like, it is an issue in real estate. It's the issue that people are all constantly looking for because it requires a lot of capital to buy. And I went down the pros and cons of a crowdsourcing model with the person. And it went down the line. It's like, hey, is short-term rentals, is that a business? you know, is WeWork a business that can work? And you know, are these businesses? And so I, every time, even if I had a negative, you know, venture capitalists a lot of times think in long terms, like, hey, this person's going to disrupt this industry and change it. So they think of negatives almost as positives. It's like, hey, with enough capital, we can disrupt it. Anyway, going back to your question, I invested alongside a lot of these companies. They would say, hey, Pete, eventually I just gave free advice because I enjoyed it. I loved it. And I would be able to trial, this is important, I was able to trial a lot of these technologies. So a firm would come to me, say, hey, what do you think of this guy? Would you actually want to trial it at Teat? I'm like, yeah, sure. Free, you know, free tech, why not? And so I would end up trialing this tech. I would say I liked it or I didn't like it, or I liked it. You should talk to X, Y, and Z, my friend, at these other real estate firms. And then eventually I would say, hey, Teat, thank you for all this free advice. Do you want advisory shares? Do you want to invest? And so I started getting allocations and I started getting smarter around, like, why are these guys are making so much money? Why can't I put money into this? Cause I'm someone helping them with their investment. So, and so I just kind of, I've made, you know, I don't know, 60 investments. I don't know how many, it's a lot, over, you know, the last few years. And so I've kind of become a really super angel.
Wow. Have you ever thought about institutionalizing that, starting your own fund? I mean, does it ever get to the point where those investments are more exciting or profitable to you than real estate? Or do you think it's possible to do both well?
I actually do have a fund called Wilshire Wayne Partners. It's a small fund. We're investing out of our second fund. And we are professionalizing. I have a partner in that business. And we make venture investments primarily focused on prop tech businesses. Where we kind of institutionalize what I do, but I also angel invest on the side outside of that business because that does later stage investments. Later meaning like A and seed. Well, I can also do like just pure angels investing on my own. Can I do both? Yeah, I certainly think I could do both. I think both help each other too. I think as a better investor in prop tech businesses makes me a better real estate investor. And vice versa, I wouldn't be able to get the prop tech investments unless I have a big real estate portfolio that's really active and utilizing the latest and greatest technologies. So I think they can work hand in hand.
That makes a ton of sense. And I've dabbled and done some angel investing as well. And when you know the space or certainly the founder, it makes a huge difference. But I also just from an intellectual standpoint and understanding how these companies are trying to solve problems, I just find it so fascinating. So that's tremendous that you can do both. So you got an incredible story here. And I know our listeners are going to take away a lot.
Thank you, James.
Over the course of your career, what would you say have been the keys to your success?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the keys to success is being self-reflective, kind of really understanding what it is that makes you tick and what is it that gets you out of bed. I think being able to step back and just saying, hey, it's not just money, because I think a lot of young people say, I just want to make a lot of money. I don't think you make a lot of money if that's your focus. I think you make a lot of money doing things that you passionate and love, because ultimately it boils down to what I think the cliche answer is just working hard. And it's like really hard to just work hard and hate what you do. I mean, I did it as an investment banker, frankly. But like, it wasn't sustainable as a business model. It was a good stepping stone to what I do now. But I wasn't personally passionate about it. And it wasn't something that got me up every morning. What I do every day, underwriting real estate deals, understanding hospitality deals, underwriting venture deals, I love. And so it's not work. You know, people ask what are my hobbies. I'm like, my hobbies are my work because I love it. It's like, I get to design hotels. I get to back incredible entrepreneurs. You know, that's what I love. And then doing that self-reflective deep dive and saying, hey, what do I really love? You know, not being silly. I mean, like, I didn't mean it that way. Like, you want to be an artist doing art. That's great. You probably might not make a lot of money because the probability to be successful is probably not high unless you're just really great at it. But it depends on what type of art, but maybe you can use that art skill to do something else that actually makes sense. Like maybe you can be an interior designer. That's amazing. And that sort of thing. You know, I think really kind of being self-reflective, what makes you get up every morning is really important.
I'm going to make sure my 16-year-old son listens to this interview very carefully because when I asked him, what do you want to do? He says, I want to make a lot of money. There's certainly a lot more to life. And I love what you had to say about being self-reflective and passion. Although, and I've got to add from your bio, real estate enthusiast. I have not, you know, I've not heard, you know, in someone's bio and this entrepreneurial spirit. So, I mean, you definitely embody it.
Thank you. It's true. Like, I love real estate. I do. I love hospitality real estate. I love that we can actually make a difference in people's lives and make experiences for them and make them feel better every day and house them and make them feel safe and everything else. I think it's just it makes me connect with people. So I love it.
Absolutely. I completely feel the same way. So, and then just last question, what advice would you give? And we have a lot of listeners to our show who are still in college and they're thinking about getting into real estate, or maybe someone who's even, maybe they're thinking of switching fields. Maybe it's an investment banker who's listening to the show right now. I mean, what advice would you give them to break into real estate and be successful?
Yeah. Biggest advice I do is just do a deal, do a small deal. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing a two unit duplex on the outskirts of the city that you've used your life savings to invest in, or got some friends and family ideally to put a few bucks in, but it's not a lot. Do your first deal, then do your second deal, and then do your third deal. Don't start big, because there's no need. In real estate, you have enough folks that also like real estate, that also want to invest in real estate, that all to develop a track record isn't that hard. You know, you just have to do a few deals and all of a sudden you're a real estate investor. And I think just don't think about the first 100 unit deal in Manhattan, and like, just it's an uphill climb. It's hard. Just start with something. Get it under your belt and move on. It's so much easier. It's you know, not complicated.
That's an awesome way to end, and just so inspiring. I really hope our listeners take this to heart. So thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thanks, James, for the time. I appreciate it.
Wonderful. This is your host, James Nelson of Real Estate Investing, live from New York. If you have not already, make sure and connect with me at James Nelson NYC on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and certainly check out my newest website, which I have just released at jamesnelson.com. You can find all my podcasts, an exclusive video series that teaches insider's edge to real estate investing. So until next week, thank you again.
A different approach to putting our clients first. Avis & Young's Tri-State Investment Sales Group sells multifamily, office, retail, development, and specialty sales throughout the New York metro area. As experienced thought leaders in their industry, our 35-member group is available to help you make informed investment decisions by advising you on your current holdings or identifying new opportunities in the marketplace. Our one unified team is built on an industry-unique platform which promotes unparalleled collaboration and teamwork. We share core values of hard work, integrity, and expertise. We put our clients first, providing tailor-made strategies to achieve superior results. Please visit us at aytristateinvestmentsales.com and follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram at JamesNelsonNYC to learn more.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Real Estate Investing Live from New York. Please join your host, James Nelson, for another program next Tuesday at 7 p.m. in New York, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. All shows are rebroadcast on Wednesday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern Time and 4 a.m. Pacific Time, as well as always on demand. We'll talk again next week.